Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here on the day after summer solstice 2020. It has been a very gray June to this point and the forecast looks like more of the same. I think there's just been one day where it was considered mostly or only partly cloudy. Otherwise, it's been mostly cloudy to completely overcast. And with these heavy cloudy days that we've been experiencing here and some rain, it's been easy to forget that we are at the longest days of the year. It has been interesting to get out. There's a lot of birds around with young out of the nest. Some of the earlier resident nesting birds, juncos and song sparrows, both having young birds. I think chickadees as well have started to fletch. So nice time to get out and see some of those young birds and the antics that they might get up to. If you're getting out, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. It's also a good time of year to see wildflowers, lots of stuff blooming down at low elevations and here in Sitka where we can get up Harbor Mountain Road. It is now open to the top and spent some time up there in recent days. It's kind of like going back in time a little bit this time of year. Things just starting to come out there and starting to green up a little bit as the last of the snow starts to melt at some of the higher elevations, or at least at that level and even higher elevations. It'll be a while yet before the snow melts. So this week's conversation is one that I originally recorded back in October of 2013. With Joseph Cook. He is a mammalogist currently with the University of New Mexico as the curator of mammalogy at the Museum of Southwestern Biology. He was in town in October of 2013 as part of the Scientists in Residence Fellowship at the Sitka Sound Science Center. Had a chance to go see a talk of his as well as talk to him for this show. He's done a lot of work on mammal biogeography, he and his graduate students in Southeast Alaska. He's also co-author of Recent Mammals of Alaska. So we'll go ahead and join the conversation with a little bit of talk about parasites and how they inform what we know about mammals and the history of mammals. And from there, go on to talk more about mammals in Southeast Alaska. So with that, we'll go ahead and join the conversation. And I was at your talk, I guess maybe even a couple weeks ago already, and you also were talking about parasites. Is that more your students have looked at parasites, or do you also look at the parasites on the mammals?
Yeah, so the cool thing about each mammal is that we're host to a number of other organisms, mm-hmm. which we call parasites.
Yeah.
And these can be parasites that live on the outside, like fleas and ticks and mites, or they mm-hmm. can be what we call endoparasites, which are things that are generally found in the guts, but sometimes in other parts of the body.
Yeah.
And so each of those organisms has, you know, a story to tell as well as the mammal that we're looking at. And so actually, beginning quite a long time ago when I was a graduate student, I began working with parasitologists.
Yeah.
And the first big project was down in Bolivia. And there was a parasitology graduate student who was the nephew of a very famous Alaskan biologist whose name is Robert Rausch.
Mm-hmm.
And Rausch was in Fairbanks starting in the late 40s up and through the late 70s, although he maintained a home in Wiseman for years.
Mm-hmm.
Very famous parasitologist. And Rausch worked a lot with bush communities to understand human health. He was actually a public health service scientist. And worked on a number of parasites of mammals, but also birds and a number of other organisms. And so this fellow, this other graduate student, was his nephew, and we went to the field together in Bolivia in 1984, and he was just so enthusiastic about all these other things we were finding in each mammal specimen. And so that's sort of where I caught the bug,
so to speak. Yeah. So I guess the example that you had mentioned that time in particular, as I recall, I think it was a question after the talk where you were looking at Martin on Chichikov Island, I think, and that there may have been a population of Martin there prior to introduction, but there was definitely an introduction, and maybe it was a student of yours that had been looking at nematodes or something.
Right, it was a nematode, yeah.
Yeah, and looking at not only the genetics of the Martin themselves, but also the genetics of this nematode that were associated with them, and getting multiple strands of evidence for sort of reconstructing a history of the species on that island.
Right. Yeah, so one of our interests is to try and figure out what the history of, say, the mammals have been in Southeast mm-hmm. Alaska. If we suspect that most of this area was covered by ice, then most of the species should have recolonized in the last 10,000 years, although now we have signals of things persisting here in refugia.
Mm-hmm.
But each of those mammals would have brought its parasites with it. And
yeah.
So what we want to do is bring as many different lines of evidence to the table as we can. And so for biologists, that would be the mammals and the plants and
mm-hmm.
and the birds and so forth. But then all the parasites that are on those organisms also leave a trace signal as to what their origin was, where they may have come from. And so the great story with the nematode, which is known as Sobolophyme batcherini, which is a big nematode that probably a lot of marten trappers have seen. It's found in the guts of these things. It's a very large nematode. Is that they had a signal of the origin of marten, the marten that are on Chichagof Island, from prior introductions of marten to the
yeah.
island. So marten were actually introduced to the island. Actually, they were introduced to Baranof, and then some of those from Baranof were introduced to Chichagof. And then at the same time, they also brought other marten from near Thomas Bay and also from Anchorage. And so the worms had the signals of worm populations from each of those source populations. In addition, there was a worm that couldn't be traced to any of those, and that was actually closer to another species of marten that we have in Southeast, which is the Pacific marten. And so the one that was introduced is the American marten. The one that perhaps was there prior to this introduction was the Pacific marten,
mm-hmm.
and that worm then may have been the signal of that prior existence of the other marten on the island. So it becomes very complicated, and that's why you want to use many lines of evidence.
So is there both species of marten on Chichagof now, or is there only known to be the one?
Yeah, there's only known to be the Americana, and that was always thought to be the story, that there were no marten on Chichagof, and that's why they introduced the Americana. But it looks to us as though the Pacific marten was probably on that island. We find Pacific marten today on Admiralty,
mm-hmm.
on Kew Island, and on Kew Island, actually, the American and Pacific marten both occur now, and they're actually hybridizing, so it's active hybridization that's going on there. They're also on Dahl Island, which is something we haven't published yet. The Pacific marten is on Dahl Island, and only the Pacific marten. And then if you go further south, you find them on Haida Gwaii and the Queen Charlotte's.
So they're, given their distribution, then that would suggest that they're pretty strong coast. So they go further south?
They go further south all the way down the coast, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, but they are very much a coastal.
They're a coastal form, but if we were to hypothesize what the history of that species was after the glacial recession, after the glaciers receded, it looks like they expanded from the coast and they also went east. And so now mm-hmm. they formed a contact zone with the American marten that extends across southern British Columbia and then across northern Idaho and into Montana and all the way actually to Wyoming.
Oh, okay.
And so there's a pretty broad contact zone between those two species in the lower 48 and in British Columbia.
And so I guess, I mean, just kind of get back to the big umbrella sort of question, it's trying to reconstruct some histories using genetic evidence and what we know of the geology in terms of glaciation and that sort of thing. And for a lot of these, it sounds like it's sort of post-last ice age, but maybe are you also considering sort of or looking at deeper sort of relationships even further back in history, or are you mostly just trying to reconstruct the last, 10 to 15,000 years?
Yeah. We're trying to do it in as many sort of layers as we can.
Mm-hmm.
And so we actually begin by just sort of building trees among species to understand what species limits are.
Yeah.
And that gives us then the framework for interpreting variation within a species. So if you can understand, what are the limits between species, then you have a much stronger platform to begin to investigate what variation is within a species across space. And so, for example, with these marten, they were originally described as two separate species morphologically.
Yeah.
And then and that was about 100 years ago, a little over 100 years ago. And then 50 years ago, a fella lumped them together into a single species.
Yeah.
Based on the fact that they hybridize. And then we looked at them genetically, and clearly these two forms have had very different histories and have been separate for a long time, but now they do hybridize. And that's true of polar bears and brown bears, for example.
Yeah.
We wouldn't consider polar bears and brown bears the same species, even though they hybridize. And so we know that hybridization can take place. And that's sort of why it's important to define the limits of the species before you then try to look at variation within the species to look at its history.
Yeah.
Because hybridization can sort of is another complicating factor. So the recent story that's very, very fun with brown bears and black bears is it looks like, you know, we were thinking based on a single genetic marker that they had split only 100,000 years ago,
yeah,
which suggests very rapid morphological evolution for the polar bear, which is a very distinctive...
Oh, so brown bears and polar bears. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But now it looks like brown bears and polar bears actually split about 2.5 million years ago, but then they have hybridized again on at least three occasions during the last 2.5 million years.
Yeah.
And so that's where hybridization complicates the story and why, again, you want multiple pieces of evidence to try and track the history of these species.
And so without getting into, I mean, too much technical detail, which I'm not sure I would even understand necessarily, but, you know, from my experience, with reading conversations about large gulls, for example, large white-headed gulls, and gulls are notoriously promiscuous between apparent species, and to the point where in some places hybrids outnumber, you know, so-called pure species by great numbers, and that there are sort of different species concepts that may be used in different areas of biology, and I don't actually know, like, so in mammals, how is it that you're deciding, you know, it sounds like you have some genetics and you're looking at those relationships, but how are you making these clear lines and distinctions between, is it arbitrary or is there like something, something that you can sort of hang your hat on and say, these are clearly different species?
Yeah, it's a great question. And actually, if you want to start a great debate among biologists, just ask them what species concept they like.
Right. Yeah.
There's been a number of species concepts published. It's not an easy thing actually to think about because evolution is a continuum, and so it's not as though at some particular point things become distinctive species necessarily.
Yeah.
Over long periods of time, then you begin to recognize morphological differences, you know, colors or patterns or shape or whatever it might be. Many times species won't change that much morphologically, even though they've separated a long time ago, and that's where genetics becomes very important for helping us track that. Now, people have proposed that, you know, at a 5% genetic difference that these should be different species.
Yeah.
That's been proposed recently for mammals. The problem is, again, that speciation can be an ongoing process.
Yeah.
And therefore, it may be initiated but not quite completed, and so the question is, when exactly should you declare them separate species? And 5% may be a little arbitrary in certain circumstances.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess the concept I use and my lab uses primarily is one that's called the phylogenetic species concept, which basically is that species are on their own independent trajectory, and that they have begun to accumulate differences that indicate that they are no longer reproducing, exchanging genes at a significant level. At some point in the future, they may come back into contact and exchange genes in a very limited area. That's what we call a hybrid zone.
Yeah.
And actually, with climate change, we suspect there will be an increase in hybridization, like what has recently been reported for brown bears and polar bears, where there are few hybrid individuals
picked up.
Even if you do have limited hybridization, if there's not massive exchange of genes between these species and free interbreeding, then in fact they would still be considered separate species.
So I guess just sort of as an intellectual model map, I think of it as kind of a tree of ever outward spreading branches, but in reality, maybe a braided river might be more appropriate in some respects, where they can start to separate, and then, you know, for whatever reasons, maybe it's an ice age, and then they get split, and then the ice goes away, and they come back together.
Right.
And so they could have been on separate trajectories, and then geological phenomenon occurred that brought them back before they separated completely. So then they could then reemerge into a you know, a single species again. And so it may be that things...
And that's the most common thing that happens, actually, because the ice ages were not of very long duration.
Mm-hmm.
So many populations were fragmented into smaller populations. We see the same thing on the Alexander Archipelago here, where you have different mammals populations on different islands.
Mm-hmm.
They probably have not been on these islands and separated for very long, for long enough to accumulate differences that would allow them to no longer interbreed.
Yeah.
And so, again, that's why the islands are such a great model for looking at this question of evolution and speciation,
mm-hmm.
is how long does it take and what sort of characteristics have got to be acquired to keep to keep these populations from interbreeding in the future. If they won't, if they don't interbreed in the future, then they are on their own trajectory and they were becoming separate species. But for most populations that are separated, when they come back into contact, for whatever reason, they can interbreed. So evolution is not, you know, divergence is, takes time to evolve, and you have to evolve certain characteristics that would keep you from interbreeding. And so there's a whole field of study on that, and these are things that we call reproductive barriers that would keep species from interbreeding. Often they're behavioral cues.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're morphological. There's a number of these characteristics that, that prevent widespread interbreeding of or intermixing of different species.
Yeah, a friend of mine that I talked to a bit before is a biologist and really interested in evolutionary ideas and so forth. Is, you know, he made the comment, or maybe he was quoting somebody else, but you know, when if frogs, for example, they mate, you know, according to the song, but there had to be a female out there that liked the male song, you know, in order for that to really make a difference.
Right.
If a male sings a different song, but there's nobody there to hear it that likes it. So it's kind of this interesting dynamic. And, of course, lots of different little...
So you bring up a great point, because in different groups of organisms, there's different cues that may lead to reproduction. And in some organisms, like plants, hybridization may be much more common than in other organisms. And certain kinds of plants, for example, sunflowers, are notorious for hybridizing.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, most mammals are not that way.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess, you know, in talking to another botanist friend, the plants, and then they'll just up their chromosome numbers and all sorts of things like that, ploidy levels, I guess. And animals don't seem to have that ability so much.
That's right. Yeah, and it's a very interesting thing, because the high Arctic plants show very elevated levels of ploidy, which means that a plant may start out with 12 chromosomes and then it will double the number of chromosomes and will no longer be able to interbreed with the one with 12. So the 24 can't breed with the 12. And that may go on and go on and go on, producing multiple species that have different, what we call ploidy levels, or different numbers of chromosomes.
Yeah.
It's really common in Arctic plants, and there's some suggestion that in really harsh environments or environments that are highly variable, that may be an advantage to do that, because then you have, you know, more variation and more ability to respond to changes as it comes along.
Yeah, and I guess, so an interesting question to me, and I'm curious about, is, you know, there's, you mentioned, there's just a lot of different islands in Southeast Alaska and in the mainland, and, you know, things came back. Most of it was under ice. It seems like it's likely that there was stuff that was exposed either very early or continuously throughout. And what, if anything's managed to persist out here, I guess not entirely clear. But you know, that variation and, you know, what are the barriers right now? It's mostly just water, I guess. I don't know how much, like Chichikov and Baranof are, I don't, you know, the narrows there are really quite narrow,
right.
And I don't, like, so Martin, why are they able to, are they not able to swim at all, or could they move across there pretty easily? And, and likewise other small mammals. 'Cause I know there are some mammals that are on, there's a vole that's on, like everywhere, but Baranof, it seems like, and you know, what's, they just don't like to swim, or is there, do you have a sense of what's sort of keeping things separate? Some of the larger water crossings, I'm sure, are a barrier, especially for the smaller mammals. But
yeah, it's a great question. And again, it's why it's such a great opportunity to study these kinds of questions here in Southeast Alaska, because we can set up different scenarios of what should be strong barriers for certain species, but maybe not for other species. And we can look at islands like Forester, which sits out there all by itself.
Yeah.
And so we can come up with basically hypotheses or sets of questions as to which species should respond most strongly to these barriers and which ones, like, say, a semi-aquatic species that it shouldn't bother at all.
Right.
And then we can test those ideas using genetics to see if there's a lot of exchange, or what we call gene flow, between certain islands. And what we find typically is that for islands like Chichagof and Baranof, there's a high similarity among populations genetically, across most species. But when you look at, you know, something that's separated by a very wide strait, that those kinds of islands are not very similar to all those island populations. Or if we look at a setup like Mitkov, Kuprinov, and Kyu, basically, because Mitkov is so close to the mainland, you essentially, and each of those is close to each other, you have a peninsular effect.
Yeah.
Where it's very easy for mainland species that maybe haven't colonized other islands in Southeast to colonize all the way out to Kyu.
Yeah.
Or certainly to colonize to Kuprinov. And so we see things like moose and so forth moving onto those islands that maybe aren't making it onto other islands elsewhere.
Yeah.
So you have all these different setups, and it makes just a great set of experiments to test these ideas about what barriers are and how they affect species as they differentiate. And then the other thing you mentioned is the time element, because, again, the longer things are separate, the more likely they are to diverge.
Yeah.
And so if we can really begin to understand what the time scale is that we're looking at, that things were actually able to begin to differentiate when they first got into the area and how long they've been here and how long they've been separated, then we can begin to understand how long it takes things to actually become different or distinctive. And so if there was a refugium here in Southeast during that glacial advance and certain species persisted in that refugium, then that gives us a much deeper time frame for understanding evolution and understanding how quickly or how differently things can become over time.
And so the trick then, I suppose, is to determine which things would have been here.
Right.
And so you're using the genetics. It seems like, is it the one of the myotes, the redback voles maybe, that I'm just trying to remember what I read in the book, and it seems like that there was a northern population and a southern population that came into the Stikine region and may have actually, and there's a hybrid zone in there, but those seem like that maybe had been an earlier hybridization, and they actually now are coming back in again. I don't know if you know off the top of your head kind of that story, and I know I don't have it clearly in my head, but it seemed like it was kind of an interesting dynamics there.
Right. So that's a great example. There's two species, the northern redback vole, Myotes rutilus, and the southern redback vole, which is Myotes gapperi. Rutilus was probably in a northern refugium, what we call Beringia, which was an ice-free area in interior Alaska and extending into Asia during the last glacial maximum about 28,000 years ago. And it moved south, and it came into contact with this other species, the southern redback vole, which moved north from a southern refugium. And they form a very wide contact zone that extends from the Pacific Ocean from here in southeast all the way to Hudson Bay. And these species seem to exclude each other. And so when they come together, they hybridize, but very limited hybridization goes on. And the gene flow, the amount of exchange of genes, doesn't extend outside of that hybrid zone very far. So they're clearly, although some individuals, when they come into contact, will hybridize, it's not widespread, and it's not affecting the integrity of those two species. The story you were referring to in Southeast is related to a tidewater glacier on the mainland that where we genetically can track contact between these two species about 5,000 years ago, and then their separation by a tidewater glacier that has kept them apart since then. And we can track that because they hybridized about 5,000 years ago, and there's one particular set of genes that moved from the northern species into the southern species and has changed since that time over a period of about 5,000 years. So that's how we're able to track this earlier event, even though they're not in contact now.
So if and when that glacier recedes far enough to no longer be a tidewater glacier, then presumably they would
come back into contact.
So then that would start to mix up and add another layer of signal.
Potentially, yeah. Exactly.
So
it can get very complicated.
So I guess, you know, when you can absolutely observe that in sort of present day kind of situations, that I imagine it's a little easier to untangle some of those. But just trying to think about how that might, how you might be able to look back in time and untangle all of that. It seems like it could be a bit of a challenge.
So Yeah, and so that's the sort of the beauty of where we're at with genetic data these days is, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, we were using single genes to look at these questions. But because our genomes are made up of many genes and are very large, there's a lot of information in respective genomes of all these organisms. And so, and also because these genes sit on different chromosomes, they get mixed up every time that a species breed, essentially, because you pull different chromosomes from the mother and from the father. And so they remix every time. And so essentially all of those genes are somewhat independent markers of the history of the species.
Yeah.
And so if you use a single gene to sort of untrack the history, then that basically gives you a very fundamental hypothesis that you can go back and retest with a number of independent lines of evidence or other genes.
Yeah.
And that's how we're able to tell the story of multiple hybridization events between polar bears and brown bears.
Yeah.
And the other thing that has played into that polar bear brown bear story is the fossils.
Yeah.
So if we can pick up fossils from 100,000 years ago, then you've actually got a signature of what the genetic variation was like in those species at that time.
Yeah.
And that adds another critical piece of information.
So are you able to extract DNA from remains that are that old?
Yeah, this summer they just released a full genome of a fossil horse from Yukon that was 700,000 years old.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
So it's been in permafrost or?
Yeah, but the technology has changed dramatically just in the last 5 years, the chemistry, the way we actually are able to look at the genetic signal. And so we no longer need to amplify the signal. We can now actually go in and cut it apart or cleave it apart one base at a time. And that makes these fossils much more much easier to work with because the DNA in these fossils is highly fragmented and it's in fairly short pieces because over time it degrades.
Right.
And so by using a technique where you're cleaving a single base at a time, you can actually put together these genomes from long extinct organisms.
Wow. Huh. Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of interesting sort of stuff, questions that can be asked, I guess, and looked into with genetic approaches that are becoming, I imagine, quite a bit cheaper and easier to do. And I imagine the reason people looked at one gene before was because that's all they could sort of afford to do, perhaps. And
yeah, the way the field's evolved is it started with humans, and that's where the big emphasis, and that was the first genome, you know, where they put a lot of effort into getting the whole thing. They had genomes of simpler things.
Yeah.
The organisms that I work on, like the marten and the ermine and the voles that you mentioned, are what we call non-model organisms.
Yeah.
And it's taken a lot longer to get the technology to a point where we can begin to look at those genomes, but now it has.
Yeah.
And so now we're able to look at wildlife and plants and other things besides humans.
Yeah.
Which actually more interesting in a lot of ways.
Well, there's a lot more stories to be told. So that's one thing I'm a little curious about as well. Looking through the Mammals of Southeast Alaska book there, it's the shrew story. And I think there was four shrews that were listed, one of which may be a subspecies of the water shrew, the Glacier Bay shrew, which is not really well known. But the shrews of particular interest to me were, Cinereus and Sorex. So the dusky shrew, I think, and Monticulus, the masked shrew, I guess, or however, whatever the common name ends up getting used for it. But that one of them was essentially everywhere except for the northern outer islands, and the other one was everywhere except the southern outer islands. And so there was a massive amount of overlap, but somehow one of them got into the Prince of Wales area and one of them got into the Baranof-Chichikov area. Do you have like hypotheses or ways of trying to figure out how and why that happens, or is it just sort of one of those mysteries to be out there?
Well, no. So again, with the genetics, we can begin to try and understand what the origin of those populations might have been. The fact that they're exclusive, that one species is on the southern islands and another one's on the ABC islands, is the same pattern we see with brown bears versus black bears and wolves that are on the southern islands. We see it in the voles. And it's a general principle that islands tend to have simpler faunas and floras. So they're always a subset of what you may exist on the mainland. With the genetics, we can begin to try and understand why that might be. But part of it may be that there's not as many niches available on an island that's smaller.
Yeah. Yeah.
And therefore, the shrew niche, for example, which is not really correct terminology, but that area that shrews may occupy could not be subdivided between two species on these islands, and so either one species got it or the other. Now, clearly, because of their distribution that's exclusive, it suggests that they had probably different opportunities to colonize those two mm-hmm. regions at different times. And one of them got on, and that maybe excluded the other one from being able to make it to those islands.
To survive.
Right. Yeah. But the interesting thing about the dusky shrew is that it appears... again, we look at the origin and when these things either came into southeast Alaska or whether they persisted here in a refugium.
Mm-hmm.
And the dusky shrew is comprised of two different lineages that suggest at least two different colonizations of southeast by that shrew.
Yeah.
Now, we're not considering those two different species, but they're pretty distinctive genetically. In fact, at the approaching the 5% level, that level that some mammalogists would call them distinctive. But genetically, we can show that that there were at least two different colonizations of that shrew type, probably from different sources and from different routes.
And are they on different islands then, or when they meet, do they intermix? Or
well, we don't know. We don't have good enough sampling. Where they would meet would be north of Juneau.
Okay.
So you have one type in Haines.
Yeah.
And then the other one that's pretty much everywhere else in southeast.
Yeah.
Same way with long-tailed vole, we have two types. We have an island clade, and then we have another one that's found farther north up into interior. And so their contact zone is probably around Haines as well. So something very dynamic is happening in the Haines area, which is sort of what you might predict. But where multiple forms, probably from different source populations or different refugia,
mm-hmm.
have come into contact. And then the question is, when they come into contact, do they hybridize widely or do they pretty much maintain separate populations? We don't have the answers to those questions yet.
Right.
Because it takes a lot of sampling and sample size to figure those sorts of things out.
So I guess that gets to a question of Southeast Alaska is not that big of an area. I mean, it's not tiny. Obviously, it's pretty remote. We don't have a very big population. I'm not sure, you know, based on looking on the dots and the maps, it looks like there's been a fair amount of sampling of some things. My guess is that you would say Southeast Alaska in many places is very poorly sampled and surveyed for mammals.
Yeah, and I guess there's kind of two sides to that. One is the survey,
mm-hmm.
and that is the species present or absent.
Yeah.
And then the other one is the sampling. And so, it's really critical to get, number one, good sample size, which means not have just a single individual or single sighting to represent mm-hmm. a species on an island, but actually to collect information so that we can understand variation within the population of that island, so that we can compare that variation to a population on another island. And that then begins us to allow us to say, for example, how much gene flow or how much exchange is there between mm-hmm. these. The other thing is, if you're interested in parasites, you have to have large sample size because most individuals are not infected.
Yeah.
And so if it's a parasite that's in low percentage of the population, you have to sample fairly heavily to actually say that this population has this parasite or not. But a lot of what we're doing is just building archives
mm-hmm.
of this material that will allow people in the future to come back and probe these populations in more detail, whether they're interested in parasites or they're interested in mammal genetics or they're interested in looking at diet.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do very interesting things now with stable isotope analysis.
Oh, yeah.
Where you can actually figure out food webs or you can figure out diet. If they're interested in contaminants, you can look at all kinds of contaminants in samples
mm-hmm.
if you have samples available and samples archived. And that's why we're really interested in building these big archives representing as many species as possible on as many islands as possible to provide a really powerful window into what the conditions were in those populations at particular times.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started the work in 1991. There's no way to go back to 1991 and get samples unless somebody archived them in that year.
Right.
And so if we want to make a comparison between now and 1991, say 22 years later, you really need those baselines samples to be able to say this was the condition at that time and this is the condition today. And so a lot of what we're doing is building archives for future scientists
yeah.
to be able to do any kinds of studies. Studies we haven't even thought about. The area has been dynamic for a long time. Again, mm-hmm. the Ice Age, there were 24 major glaciations. And so over that 2.4 million years, there was a lot of dynamic back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so understanding how species responded to that in the past is really going to give us a foundation for understanding how species are going to change in the future, change their ranges. The other thing I would say is, though, I'm 55 now.
Yeah.
And in my lifetime, our population has doubled in size
yeah.
on this planet. And the kinds of changes we're seeing now are pretty much unprecedented. So the last 4 decades has really been an important time for us to understand what kinds of changes are taking place that are natural, that are normal, that are within the natural variation.
And yeah.
what kinds of changes maybe are outside of that norm and are in response to some of the other things that are happening right now on the planet. And that's part of what drives my desire to build these archives, is because I know these baselines will be really critical for people to understand, you know, how those changes are playing out and how we might be able to mitigate or respond to those changes.
Yeah. Yeah, and I suppose living here, you know, in Sitka in particular, it's like it's changed in the nearly, you know, the 30-some years that I have an awareness of. And speaking to people that have been here for a lot longer, there's definitely been changes, but it's been gradual. And you know, all I have to do is fly in and see that, you know, Sitka is just this tiny ribbon. And it's really, you know, from a human perspective, not really gone a dramatic change. You know, clear-cut logging being the most dramatic sort of obvious impact that humans have had in the region. But in other places, I'm sure that there's a lot more buildup of cities and expansion of cities into farmland or rural area, or just even the creation of farmland. And so it's interesting to me to think about just the ways that things have changed and then the responses. And some animals do and plants do quite well with human disturbance, and others much less so.
Right.
The movement of one of the things that you talked about in your talk was the movement of the introduction of species, and at least in theory, it seems like to me that could be a net positive for an area. I mean, obviously, in some cases, if you get rats in there and it's a bird colony island, then the rats can just devastate those bird populations. But as you were mentioning, for the high Arctic plants, when they have additional diversity, they can respond more readily to changes. And so I wonder, you know, about a lot of the times when you hear about invasives, it's we got to get rid of them. And I wonder if in some cases that seems like that's clearly the case, and if other cases maybe there's ways to integrate them and overall make things more responsive or something. I don't know. I'm curious about that question, though.
Yeah, I think people are talking about that. They certainly talk about what they call the semi-natural matrix now.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that a lot of biodiversity is in, you know, what we would not consider a natural habitat for them over the course of their evolutionary history.
Yeah,
it's a tough question. Invasives are going to be with us. Humans move things around. We have a lot of invasive questions in the lower 48. The Forest Service doesn't spend a lot of effort here on the Tongass on invasives, but in the lower 48, almost every forest is spending, you know, a good part of their budget on looking at invasives
mm-hmm.
and what they're causing. In some cases, you know, invasives have been with us for a long time. The iconic tumbleweed
right.
is an invasive, and yet that's how we think of New Mexico, for example.
Yeah.
But there's other invasives down there that have caused major problems. And so just understanding these invasives. Now, I think you have a special case here in Southeast because you're on an island archipelago, to be really wary of invasives.
Yeah.
Because it's been invasives that have caused lots of problems for biodiversity on islands like Hawaii and other island systems as we look around the globe. Invasives brought by humans have caused big problems. Rats are another one.
Yeah, yeah.
And red squirrels, even red squirrels here, probably when they were introduced, may have had a major hit on nesting bird populations.
Well, that's an interesting thing because, you know, on the mainland, there are red squirrels and there are grouse, for example. There's a book, a hunting book by a guy named Les Yaw, who moved here in the 20s, early 20s,
And it was a book of hunting stories he was working on, as I think when he passed away and his kids put it together and published it. But one of the things that somebody just quoted to me recently was, you know, you can always, if you don't get a deer, you can always count on a hooter on your way back for, you know, meat for the table. I have seen one grouse that somebody caught. You know, I've heard of a handful of sightings of grouse. I've heard a handful of them over the years. But there just aren't very many grouse around here, especially compared to what it sounds like they used to be. And, you know, there's been, I've heard both marten and squirrels, but my understanding is, at least on Chichikov where they studied, the marten pretty much exclusively voles in terms of animals. And there's certainly plenty of voles here they could eat here. But the squirrels are definitely nest predators. And so I wonder, you know, maybe it's just, and even ptarmigan, they're a little easier to find, but they don't sound to be as abundant as they were formerly. And so I wonder if the squirrels have just really, but yet they coexist on the mainland. Mm-hmm. and there seem to be plenty of grouse on the mainland, for example. So maybe it's just a behavioral thing that they were isolated here. And I think the word you used in your talk was naive to these things. And
there's been a lot written about that with mm-hmm. island populations, that if often on islands, Lucians are a great example, mm-hmm. where you've had a lot of great nesting seabird colonies. And then, you know, with fox ranching, we yeah. wiped out a lot of those. And, of course, with fox ranching, they often introduce ground squirrels as well to feed the fox. And ground squirrels are also very carnivorous and mm. can do a lot of danger. And then on other islands out there, you've had the introduction of rats from shipwrecks.
Yeah.
And the thing is that these island populations, if they evolve without predators, then they don't have the cues necessarily to respond when a new predator is introduced. And so they're very naive and they're quickly hammered, whereas they may be much more attuned to predation if they're co-evolving with them like they are on the mainland.
Yeah.
And so, again, that's the sort of thing that happens in island populations that make them distinctive from mainland.
Well, it'd be interesting, I think, to see in the future if the grouse population, I mean, because in theory they should be able to coexist with squirrels and be reasonably abundant. So it'd be interesting to see if they figure it out.
And they come back.
Yeah, and they come back.
Could be.
And I don't know if that'll happen or if there's something else that's driving the population,
sure.
You know. Animals that get hunted or trapped, I imagine, are a lot easier to get samples from, just because if you can get the cooperation of the hunters and trappers. Is that kind of your experience?
Yeah, and we've had wonderful cooperation from a number of trappers and hunters around Southeast Alaska to get us carcasses
mm-hmm.
That otherwise, you know, would probably go to the garbage bin. Very valuable specimens from marten and a number of other carnivores. In fact, John Martin here mm-hmm. in Sitka has organized the trappers here, and other folks have too over time, going all the way back to Loyal Johnson.
Yeah, yeah.
Jack
Whitman.
Jack Whitman was
yeah.
was a big supplier, and actually he still is. He's in Idaho now, and he's
right.
still
yeah.
he's really a fellow that has that museum ethic, and he thinks that stuff should be preserved so that future people will have material to work on.
Yeah, yeah. I remember maybe I don't remember who it was actually, but I think it might have been Phil Mooney was talking about that Jack started collecting mountain goat samples before they could do anything with them, but putting them in the freezer. And that they were actually able to use those then. And part of this work that I don't remember his name, Aaron something.
Aaron Schaefer.
Aaron Schaefer, yeah. In, mm-hmm. in Canada was looking at, I think his question must have been maybe his doctoral research was looking at the refugia of and populations of mountain goats. And so as I recall when he gave the talk, there was a very clear signal of a southern population and a very clear signal of a northern population that kind of came. And then it sounded like maybe there had been a population on Vancouver Island that was then later was extinct at this time. And then there was this sort of anomalous thing on Baranoff Island where, if I'm remembering correctly, it was a haplotype that was unique to Baranoff Island. And, you know, because the conventional understanding is that there were no mountain goats prior to introduction, that raised a question. And as I recall, when you came here, he was very much... he said, I don't know what's going on, but the best, you know, the best explanation that I can come up with so far is that there would have been goats here. And that's where this came from. I mean, there's other possibilities, and I'm sure there'll be ongoing work with that, presumably over time. Because it does make a, I think it changes the management dynamic also if it's a
sure.
if it's a native versus an introduced population.
Right.
But it seemed like an interesting question. And I don't know if you know a lot about the mountain goat story in Southeast Alaska, but that one seemed like it was kind of interesting.
Yeah, and that one sort of popped up out of the blue. I actually served on his PhD committee.
Oh, okay.
So I was there in Canada when he defended that work. I think, you know, the way that should be looked at is it's a hypothesis
right.
that should be examined again because it's a really important piece of evidence. I think, you know, he used microsats and mitochondrial DNA, that there's mm-hmm. Additional independent data, genes that could be used to look at that question, and it should be followed up. But there's just a lot of really cool things
yeah.
to find out yet.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, why I've been spending a little bit of time as the scientist in residence at the
right.
Sitka Sound Science Center in the schools. And that is that for those kids out there that are thinking about a career, boy, biology and coming home here and working on some of the questions here
mm-hmm.
is just a fascinating option. There's really some great stuff. We've just scratched the surface and all kinds of new things are waiting to be discovered.
So I have maybe a couple more questions about our charismatic megafauna of here. Just, the brown bears in particular. So we hear about the ABC bears, and you mentioned earlier the kind of the relationship between the brown bear and the polar bear. And for a while, the story was that it seemed like these ABC bears were more closely related to polar bears in some respects than the rest of the brown bears. But it sounds like the latest evidence is suggesting that was due to hybridization events with polar bears at some point that occurred with these bears here and not elsewhere. But are these ABC brown bears, so they're different then from the mainland, and is there any mixing that's occurring with them, or are they pretty stable in this kind of free island and surrounding smaller
yeah.
island?
So that's a great question that I think is not really resolved either.
Yeah.
There is a suggestion that the males are moving mm-hmm. back and forth, but the females are not, and so that there's gene flow from the males to the mainland, or from the mainland to the islands, but not from the females.
Mm.
And yet there are other folks that are working on this question, too, that have a very different perspective on that. So again, I think it's one of those questions, it's an important question, that the final story hasn't been told yet, and it's still out there. And I think it's going to be an interesting story when it does get told.
And so, and I guess that you mentioned earlier also that the brown bears are missing on the so somehow the black bears and wolves are presumably, I imagine that brown bears occasionally go there because they swim around and stuff, but they just don't establish on those southern islands.
Yeah, well, there's the fossil record from mm-hmm. from Prince of Wales of brown bears. And that story, too, is also going to be very interesting. People are working on that question right now. They're looking at the DNA of those fossils. And I think that's going to reveal some very different perspectives as well, just, you know, based on sort of preliminary things that people have not published yet. So
yeah.
I'm not really free to talk about. But
yeah, fair enough.
But I'll simply say that it's going to be a very interesting story as that one plays out too.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of new things. The fossils and the cave story offers great sort of temporal perspective to all this genetic variation. If you're able mm-hmm. to get the genes out of the fossils, then you can say this is what the genetic signature was in this species at this location at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And that really gives you then a nice a stamp for placing everything else in perspective. And they got a lot of fossils that came from those caves. Not all of them are going to, you know, be good enough shape to give the DNA, but
yeah.
a number of them have. And that story, I think, is going to be very cool as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds, I mean, I just have heard a little bit about it, heard a couple of talks, but they did find a lot of stuff there. And I do remember hearing about the brown bear being down there, and that I don't know if it was genetics or morphology, that it seemed like it was related to the ABC bears
right.
as opposed to the mainland.
So no genetics has been done yet on any of those fossils yet.
All right. So that was a more morphological.
Well, it's being done now, and it's being it should be forthcoming, I think, pretty quick.
Yeah, well, that'll definitely be something, that interesting story to keep track of. And then so here we have our Sitka black-tailed deer, which, strictly speaking, I guess, is considered a subspecies of mule deer. And you know, they don't really look like mule deer. When people think of mule deer, they don't really think of these guys. And so I've always been a little curious about that. I mean, what is it? They're that closely related to mule deer, which are more interior, I guess, mountain. They live in the deserts in Idaho. I mean, that's where I'm familiar with seeing them.
New Mexico. Yeah.
Down there.
Sure.
And so this coastal... and it goes, the Sitka black-tailed deer, I don't know how far south they go. I think there's a Columbia black-tailed deer that maybe is coastal, but further south.
Right. So the split seems to be in Oregon, Washington, mm-hmm. and that's work done by Emily Latch, who's at the University of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And she found a very deep genetic split between that form and the rest of what we have as far as mule deer. Mm-hmm. That you know, she continues to pursue that question, to look at the level of hybridization between those two forms along that contact zone there.
Okay, so could the Sitka black-tailed deer eventually be elevated to a species again, do you think, or are they pretty clearly a subspecies of mule deer?
That's a great question. I'm not sure how she's going to come down on that. I know she's definitely defined them as two different. Well, morphologically they're distinctive,
right?
And genetically you can pick that out too. Now you know how. What species concept she'll publish under, and that'll be debated. A lot of it, again, depends on the level of hybridization that occurs across that contact zone. I think that's what she's looking at. It takes big sample sizes, again, not only from the contact zone, but then from areas outside the contact mm-hmm. zone. So basically you go...
to see if the genes are moving through.
Right, to see how extensively that gene flow is actually occurring. And that's what she's doing now.
So are there coastal populations of the... you know, more prototypical mule deer?
I don't think so. No, that's not what I would call.
Yeah.
Inland.
Yeah. And so it seems like our black-tailed deer here are really, water is not a barrier to them, it seems like. Uh-huh. They don't mind swimming a pretty good distance. Uh-huh. And so although they haven't really gone, I don't know how far north they go without, I know they've been introduced on a couple places in Prince William Sound and so forth.
Kodiak.
And on Kodiak. So you know, what do you have a sense of what's the barrier for them? Is it like snowy winters or just lack of, maybe they just haven't had time to move?
It's a good question. You know, and again, there is a lot of dynamism in the system. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, one of the big predators elsewhere is the cougar. And that's one that's sort of moving north. And there's records of that. I think there's records now of deer in along the Alaska-Yukon border.
Oh, okay.
So, and the same way with cougar. And so I think a lot of these things, you're still seeing sort of a rebound after mm-hmm. the glacial recession for things that are still expanding their range. Of course, the cougar has a really wide distribution all the way down into South America.
Yeah.
But it may be, you know, it may be impacted by other predators as well. You know,
yeah.
Its range may be limited, what those interactions are. It's just... with regard to the deer, perhaps they're still expanding northward. They yeah. certainly have done very well in Kodiak, where they were introduced.
Yeah, yeah, and I imagine. I mean, Kodiak is kind of a little more maritime climate, I suppose, and
than interior.
Than interior, or even like Yakutat, and or as you get north, kind of Copper River and mm-hmm. stuff, you get a lot more. Like I know here, the snowy winters can really put the hurt on them. They just mm-hmm. can't find enough food,
right.
And so. And I imagine Kodiak climate is more similar to like here,
right.
But you have to go north to get back south again. And so I wonder if that maybe is part of what's just, they could go there in the summer, but you know, they would get, run out of food in the winter sort of thing.
It could be. And then there can be other things at play besides the climate. Mm-hmm. Parasites are a great example.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And they certainly limit, moose range. And there's, you know, there's all these sorts of things that come into play in different, as things move into different climates, new species they may encounter that may transmit parasites to them, mm-hmm. or there may be competition between species, or it may just be things like climate and or weather mm-hmm. and snow depth and physical parameters.
Yeah.
So there's a number of things that may limit a species range as it expands or tries to expand.
So I guess this may be a last question. Or a set of questions. I'm curious. You know, as I was telling you earlier, my interest is basically natural history. I'm not really, and I like to play with data, but I'm not much of the sciencey guy in the middle sort of thing. Doing systematic research or you know, designed research. I'm happy to talk to people about setting up those designs, but you know, actually implementing them, it's not really my forte. But I do like to wander around, and I'm happy to sort of as I find stuff, you know, make note of it. I'm probably not going to go put out trap lines and stuff, but for folks that are kind of not specialists and not really aspiring to be a specialist, are there things that they can make note of, or you know, I know that you've said that samples in particular are very helpful. So working with trappers and hunters it's been very fruitful in that regard. But are there other sort of observations that are of particular interest or things that people can do just as they're out wandering about recreating that would be useful kind of in the bigger picture?
Sure. Yeah, I guess number one, I'd just say that I'd like to get you on one of my trap lines, because if you do it once, you might want to do it again.
Well, my son would be very into that.
You never know.
Yeah.
But there are all kinds of efforts right now that allow what we call citizen scientists, basically the general public, to contribute really important information. And in a place like Southeast Alaska that's so remote, people can contribute fundamentally important information with regard to distributions of species or the timing of events, what we call chronology, mm-hmm. that is things like how early are things flowering.
Mm-hmm.
That some really important insights have come with regard to global warming and how things are flowering earlier,
mm-hmm.
just based on observations from the general public that have contributed to these databases that are online. And so there's things like iNaturalist.
Mm-hmm.
There are still the natural history museums, which will work with you to archive specimens if you want to put that kind of material
mm-hmm.
With your name permanently archived
right.
on it, so
yeah.
you can show that you know you've made a contribution. And all of those databases are available online. So if people want to get online and explore to see what kinds of information might be available for a particular island, what sort of species have been discovered there or studied. The databases not only show you that the specimen occurs there, but they're often tied to the studies that have been done on those species. And so you can dig pretty deep into understanding and learning about the biology of these organisms just by getting online and
mm-hmm.
and checking into this. This is something actually that we're pushing very hard. I'm working with folks at several other universities, University of Alaska, Fairbanks,
mm-hmm.
Harvard and Berkeley. The four of us, University of New Mexico, have a joint grant right now, and there's about 40 other institutions involved now, to use the data that are in natural history museums and other kinds of data, such as iNaturalist or eBird, to develop lesson plans for undergraduate students and for high school students, or
mm-hmm.
even lower, K-12. To use those databases to allow students to actually do their own investigations, basically pose their own questions
mm-hmm.
and then go to the web and investigate those questions, because we know that the best way to turn people on to science is to allow them to ask their own questions and go out and explore them.
Yeah.
And that's possible now. That wasn't possible without the internet, you know,
yeah.
and all of these databases being online. So that's the kind of thing that anybody can do. You don't actually have to be a student. You can, if you're just interested.
Just for fun.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming in. And yeah, this is, it's been fun for me. And glad you're able to get up here and spend a month. And it hasn't even been that bad of an October weather-wise. So.
No, it's been beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you, Matt.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded with Joseph Cook back in October of 2013 when he was here as part of the Scientists in Residence Fellowship at the Sitka Sound Science Center. He is the mammal curator at the Museum of Southwestern Biology with the University of New Mexico, also co-author of Recent Mammals of Alaska, and appreciate him taking some time out of his trip here to visit with me. And thank you for joining me here this week on the Sitka Nature Show. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.